The food ways and cuisine of Greece changed dramatically in the wake of the vast empire of Alexander the Great. Let me just briefly explain who he was first. He was Macedonian and therefore considered semi-barbarian by other Greeks. And Macedonia had kings. They spoke an odd, older dialect. They had an elite warrior class of nobles who rode on horseback. And they also had pasture land and raised beef cattle, ate prodigious amounts of food and drank themselves silly. In fact, Philip of Macedon, that's Alexander's father, was stabbed to death while drunk at a banquet in 336 BC. But it was these people who conquered all of Greece. Alexander the Great not only incorporated the entire peninsula into his empire, but also conquered Palestine, Egypt, the vast Persian Empire with lands stretching all the way to modern Afghanistan and India. In other words, everywhere we have discussed so far, and then some. And he even founded cities in most of these places, called Alexandria, after himself. And Greek culture was imported to these places, even though politically it didn't hold up as a unified empire. The successor states continued to be ruled by Greek dynasties, and they're usually descended right from Alexander's generals, like the Ptolemies in Egypt, the Seleucids in Syria. And Greek culture not only engulfed all these others, but it was enriched by them. And all these far-flung places became Greek-like, too, and that's what the word Hellenistic means. That's a period that dates from about 323 to 250 BC, until the Romans eventually sweep in and take over everything themselves. And of course, they too become Hellenized in the process. So why is this important? Well, this is the first major period after the agricultural revolution, 8 millennia before, in which there's a major exchange of animal and vegetable species from east to west, all the way across the Eurasian continent, and also from Africa to Europe and Asia. So let's call this period the Alexandrian, or maybe even the Hellenistic exchange, so we can later compare it with the Columbian exchange and various other exchanges in modern times. Not only do species and diseases travel back and forth, but whole civilizations influence each other and interact. And if the trend toward globalism, that's connecting far-flung regions together by means of trade, is one of the most important events in human history, then we have to say food is once again the catalyst. So let's first recall how simple the Greek diet was in classical times. Remember, it was just basically bread, wine, cheese, olives, vegetables, a little meat, and the Greeks traded these items across the Mediterranean. But the foods are pretty much the same from one end to the other. Okay, they imported things like dates, the herb silphium that's now extinct, but there's really not a whole lot that can't be grown in Greece. But when Alexander's empire expands, we get standard units of money across a much, much greater space. We get a lingua franca, that's Greek, that everyone can communicate in. And we get hooked up to another vast trade network, the networks of India and even of China that extend all the way out to Southeast Asia and Indonesia. And gradually, people in the West start getting things like pepper from India. In fact, our word peperi comes from the Sanskrit pipali, so it's very closely related. Long pepper was probably the first one to arrive. Ginger is also something new, usually imported dry, but physicians who mentioned it knew that it was consumed fresh where it actually grows. And what's funny is they really had no idea where these things came from or how they grew. And in fact, Dioscorides thought ginger came from India, but in fact, it's a little further east, it's Indonesia. But note also, I mentioned physicians because it was mostly as medicines that these things were first introduced. And there wasn't really a sharp dividing line between condiment and medicine in ancient times. In fact, most ancient cultures, foods are used as medicines. Other Indian spices that are introduced, kalonji, or as we call it, nigella, were imported in Hellenistic times. And it's pretty unfamiliar in the West as a food now, but if you have ever planted love in a mist, it's the little seeds inside. Spikenard was grown. That's a high-altitude, pink flowering plant, like a sort of piney in flavor. There's asafoetida or hing, which the word itself means stinking hay in Greek. So it's got a really, really strong smell when raw. But when you cook it, it mellows, and it actually replaces silphium when that goes extinct. And then there are accounts which suggest that sugar first enters into the West, although it's a medicinal curiosity. And in Europe, certainly, honey is more important. But probably the most fascinating one of these ingredients, certainly the one with the longest journey, was cinnamon and its relative cassia. The Hellenistic Greeks used it as a flavoring in their absinthe wine. It travels from Ceylon all the way through India, across the Silk Route from Central Asia to the Middle East, around Baghdad, then all the way to Europe. And you can imagine how expensive this stuff is by the time it reached Europe. Now, why is this significant? As articles of conspicuous consumption, these things confer distinction on the wealthy. And now there's a different way to eat for the sophisticated, beyond quantity or choice of origin or freshness, things that we saw, if you remember, in Orchestratus, right? But there are now spices, things that only the wealthiest people can afford. And I guess I should mention also incense, frankincense, myrrh, other aromatics that come from Arabia. Now, they're not exactly food, I know, but they're precious, and they come in the same cargoes. And that's, in fact, why they're brought by the Magi as the gifts for Jesus. But in any case, beyond spices, there is also rice, and that's brand new in the West. Not eaten in great quantities because it was pretty expensive, and actually never grown in classical times. It was always imported to Europe. But it was used more as a medicine than as a food. In fact, Galen has a recipe for rice pudding meant for invalids. So apart from these exotic imported items, there were also a number of plants that were introduced that could actually be grown in Europe. And in fact, Alexander's expeditions brought botanists along to identify viable species. A lot of the results of these are recorded in Theophrastus's Herbal. He was actually Aristotle's successor in the Peripatetic school. But also the Greek administrators who were way out in the East, they wanted familiar Greek foods. So the exchange is really two-way. Opium poppies, for example, head all the way east to Afghanistan, where they're still grown today. And I guess the most important thing to travel from east to west are citrus fruits. The earliest is probably the citron, which originated in southern China and by Roman times is planted in the western Mediterranean. Lemons come a little bit later. They look similar, but a lemon has a lot more juice and it isn't bitter. The citron is mostly used for its peel. Another important plant is called Mala Persica, or the Persian apple. We know it, of course, as the peach. And actually, it originated somewhere near Samarkand in Central Asia and traveled both east to China and west. And then there's the Armenian or Armenian apple, the apricot, which originated in China, became to Europe via Armenia, later called the praecocium. The word in Latin is lovely. It's a praecox. In Latin, it means precocious because it's the first fruit to appear in the spring. And so we get the word in English, apricot, from that. There's also jujubes, tiny little sort of date-like fruit. For some reason, they're not really known in the U.S., although if you live in the West, you can find them sometimes in supermarkets. Probably more important than particular species brought in, if I had to characterize Hellenistic civilization compared to that of classical Greece, I would say it's much more luxurious, extravagant, even opulent. And I think that's the influence of Persia, or at least ancient writers seem to think so. Alexander himself, you know, he became kind of a Persian monarch. He wore Persian robes and he demanded subjects prostrate themselves before him. It's most obvious in the art of the period, which becomes really decadent. In fact, even pornographic at some times. And you go from these sort of stern classical gods and then you get these voluptuous bodies and flowing robes, passionate emotion and real human flesh. I mean, look at the winged victory of Samothrace sometime. It's a very good example. And then there's an unctuousness, and it's evident in the culinary arts too. For all the discernment and knowledge Archestratus had, his recipes were really pretty simple. And all that changes in the Hellenistic period. And as we'll see, also the idea that Persian luxury made men soft and weak and effeminate too, and especially among the Romans who took over, of course. All this opulence was the result of increased trade, migration, spread of merchants, specialized agriculture, a slave trade, and all sorts of previously unconnected cultures suddenly mixed. And new luxuries were introduced in cooking in very new ways. Let me give you an example. It's of one. It's a meat dish from the cookbook of Epaminatus. It's also preserved in Athenaeus. And it's called a mima, okay? And it's made of any sacrificial animal or chicken. And it's made by chopping the lean meat very finely, mincing the liver and the offal with the blood, and then flavoring this with vinegar, melted cheese, silphium, cumin, thyme, leaf and seed, Roman hyssop, coriander leaf, coriander seed, geteon, which is maybe a spring onion, peeled fried onions, raisins, or honey, and the seeds of a sour pomegranate. Now, stop and think about the flavors in this. There's savory in the meat and liver, spicy in the cumin and coriander, sour in the vinegar, sweet in the raisins and honey, aromatic in the hyssop, thyme and silphium. And what does that tell us about these people? That they maybe had jaded palates, that they were very adventurous people, or that they were cosmopolitan because they could eat these things that came from all over the world? Well, along with this luxury, the Hellenistic period was also a golden age for dietary writing. And as you can imagine, all these people indulging, they kind of needed doctors too, right? To tell them how to get well. So let's turn now to the topic of nutritional theory, okay? And actually, the genre of dietary regimens begins with the Hippocratic writers, and that's the 4th or 5th century BC, so it's still classical Greek. And there was, in fact, a real historical figure named Hippocrates, but also this whole slew of other authors before and after whose writings were just ascribed to him. So when people, they generally say Hippocratic authors and just assume some of them actually lived after in Hellenistic times. So these authors were often physicians working for kings as patrons, and some of whose names we know because their writings are preserved in texts like Athenaeus. There's a Diocles of Carystus, Diphilus of Siphnus, Erasistratus, who's working in Alexandria, which apparently had the finest library in the entire ancient world, and a kind of research facility connected to it. None of these authors, however, were as important as Galen of Pergamum, who was a Greek physician who went to work for the Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius and his successors. So he's actually writing much, much later. I mean, he died around 200 AD or so. And Galen wrote more than any of his predecessors, extraordinarily prolific. In fact, there are more surviving works by Galen and more pages written by him than any other writer of all classical antiquity. His opera Omnia takes up about 30 volumes. It's massive. And Galen's importance is also that the theories he came up with were adopted by many later civilizations. So when we think about the Byzantines and the Islamic cultures and European cultures, right down to the 18th century, he is literally the medical authority for about 2,000 years. In fact, the Unani or Ionian medicine studied in India today is still based on his writings through Avicenna, who elaborated on Galen's ideas some 800 years later. And some people have argued even that the Spanish imported this medical system to the Americas, where it still survives in folk practice and there and in South America. And sometimes you hear people in South America say, oh, you know, this food is hot or this food is cold. And actually, I'll disagree with that, but we'll talk about it when we get to the New World. So leaving medical therapeutic topics aside, so I'm not going to talk about drugs or surgery, let's focus on what Galen had to say about diet and discuss the theoretical system that he pretty much invented, elaborating on Hippocrates. This is called humoral physiology. Okay? And first, this entire system is based on the already widespread idea that the whole universe is made up of four basic building blocks or elements. They are fire, water, air, and earth. And each of these can be described with qualitative terms. So hot and dry is fire, cold and moist is water, hot and moist is air, and cold and dry is earth. Now, the actual sort of water, earth, and so forth that we see on the earth, those are actually made up of several elements. They're not the pure element or its essence. And just as the universe is made up of elements, so too are our bodies. And the human body is also regulated by four basic fluids, or what they called humors, okay? And these correspond to these elements I just mentioned. And these are blood, phlegm, yellow bile, or choler, and black bile, or the Greek word melancholy. And health was defined as the proportional balance of these four fluids, though all humors are sort of born with a predominance of one particular humor, or at least a tendency for that humor to be produced in excess. And this meant that individuals could be classified as either sanguine, in which case blood dominates, or phlegmatic, or choleric, or melancholic. Get it? So an individual's humoral makeup or complexion determines what the diseases they would be subject to, their character, their emotional state, and most importantly, it determines what diet they should follow. So very unlike our own nutritional theory, there's no universal set of prescribed nutritional guidelines or even an idea of good foods or bad foods that would apply to all people. Accurate diagnosis and a tailor-made regimen for each individual was therefore considered crucial to this system. Another central idea in the system was that each humor has its own qualitative properties that can be described just like elements, as hot and moist, blood, cold and moist, phlegm, hot and dry, choler, cold and dry, melancholy. And these properties are not so much tactile measurements of temperature and humidity as they are affected by are the effect of each humor on the body. Thus, an excess or plethora of blood will make the body excessively hot and moist. And this explains why bloodletting was a popular therapy, right? You open a vein or apply leeches, and that restores the patient to this humoral balance. And equally, medicines that were classified as cold and dry in action could be administered to counteract the excessively hot and moist body, right? So this system is allopathic. It corrects by aliments. Corrects ailments by applying remedies opposite to the patient's distemperature or imbalance. So just as human bodies were said to be regulated by four humors, so too all organic matter, animals, plants, even inorganic minerals are thought to be composed of elements that gave them their own humoral properties. So a person can be described as phlegmatic, and so can a cucumber. You'd say it would be cold and moist. So matching the proper foods to the individual was key to this entire system. So hot and moist people needed cold and dry foods when imbalanced. Cold and moist people needed hot and dry foods. And there's an assumption here that very few people are ever really, really well balanced. And usually everyone needs some form of correction. So theoretically, however, healthy people should maintain their particular humor by eating foods similar in qualities to their own humoral makeup. So another crucial consideration when determining the ideal diet for a person was the texture and consistency of a given food, how quickly something would pass through the body, and how easily it could be digested was just as important as the humoral qualities. And those who receive a lot of exercise, laborers especially, were advised to eat more solid, sustaining foods like beef and beans, and athletes are prescribed enormous quantities of food. But more sedentary people were told to eat lighter foods, things that are more easily digested, that offer less nourishment, like chicken or eggs. They actually thought those were less nourishing. So occupation is one of those major factors in prescribing a diet. Along with the effect of exercise, physicians also took into account a variety of other factors that came to be known as the non-naturals. That doesn't mean unnatural, it just means sort of external factors that influence the human body as opposed to the natural or internal processes. And the non-naturals, unlike these internal processes, could be regulated at will. So we're usually they're included in a regimen or a diet. We get that word right from the Greeks. The term originally denoted not just food intake, but exercise, air quality, sleep patterns, evacuations, that means perspiration, bowel movements, and even things like sexual activity are worked into this whole system. Each of these has its own ability to heat, cool, moisten, or dry the body. So let's see how this works. For example, to correct an excessively cold person, brisk running, warming foods, sleeping well bundled, they're all prescribed as a therapeutic regimen. And even managing your emotions could play an integral part. Excessive anger makes a person choleric, and an abundance of cold, dry humors makes you melancholic. And it's funny, we still actually use these terms to describe mood and character types, right? When you think of a sanguine person, they're cheery and optimistic, right? Phlegmatics are lazy and slothful. Cholerics, you say someone's choleric, they're prone to violent outbursts of anger, right? And melancholics are, of course, sad. So Galen believed that a person's age and gender had an important influence on the humoral makeup. Young people tend to be hotter and more sanguine as they age. The body's vital fluid and heat is expended, and as they become increasingly colder and drier. And the lamp metaphor actually comes from Hippocrates. It's this idea that we're born with a certain amount of heat and moisture, and it gets burned up as we age. So younger people are thus allowed to eat colder foods, while the elderly are given warmer and more easily digested foods, especially as their digestive capacity gradually diminishes. And as a rule, interestingly, women are generally considered colder and moister than men, which is also used to explain why women are generally softer and weaker and less intelligent than men. And obviously, medical theory is used here as a tool of subjugation, but it also meant that a woman's diet should be very different than a man's. Diet should also vary by season. So weather conditions naturally affect a person's internal temperature and humidity, and therefore heating foods are more appropriate for winter and cooling foods for summer. People were also advised to eat more food in colder months, and both less and lighter foods in the summer. And the logic is that the digestive heat of the stomach is withdrawn into the surrounding air, so you need lighter foods. And of course, we do like to eat lighter foods in summer. It makes perfect sense. It's probably sort of empirically learned, right? In practical terms, it seems very unlikely that in any given household, an entire family with different needs could be served different foods to suit each individual's unique complexion. But for those with wealth, to serve many different foods in each course, I mean, we're thinking kings, emperors, the really wealthy, or even for individuals who could freely choose what they ate, these medical theories offered a really powerful system for categorizing foods and for describing which foods to eat and deciding what's best for each person. And you know, there are still very interesting rudiments of humoral physiology in our way of thinking about food. You know, why is it that something cold and moist, in humoral terms, like lemonade, sour flavors are cold and moist, is used to counteract the heat and dryness of summer, okay? Or why a condiment that's cutting and abstersive, that means it sort of purges and cleanses the system, like something like mustard, okay, that's hot, is good to accompany with something that's tough to digest, like beef, okay? When we think of a, you know, mustard on our hot dog, there's a weird humoral logic to that, okay? Or especially when we refer to something like a martini as dry. It's not dry, it's liquid, right? But it's humorally dry because it puckers the mouth. It has an astringent effect on the tongue, right? When we think of peppers as hot, in fact, our whole use of that term, hot for spicy, that's an essentially humoral descriptor. And there's a whole slew of other places that we still, when you say, you know, starve a cold and feed a fever, or is it the other way around? But you get my point, that there's still a humoral logic in much of the things that we do. Okay, let's talk also about some new ideas about food in this period. There are a couple of new philosophical schools I'd like to mention, and they pop up in the Hellenistic period and remain very, very influential in Roman times. And they also have these very interesting attitudes toward food. So let's start with the Stoics. And I think the associations you probably have with that word, Stoicism, are probably pretty accurate. These are people who thought you should not show your emotions because it makes you weak. You know, keep a stiff upper lip and don't get too attached to things that are ephemeral, like your loved ones. And, you know, it's kind of a strange philosophy, but it's one that calls for a lifestyle that's very austere and simple and does not use luxuries. Their logic is that these things you will lose, they'll make you weak. Don't become dependent on soft things, okay? And in a way, it was indirectly influential on a whole train of Christian thought, and especially their ideas about the soul, which can be strengthened by denying the body, right? So it's not necessarily asceticism yet, but it's kind of close to it. And if you think about it also, you know, Plato wasn't ascetic or even austere. He just thought you shouldn't worry too much about food. But for the Stoics, it is very clear that self-denial gives you a kind of spiritual strength, or gives you virtue, because you don't need those things, and that therefore you live a sort of tough life, okay? And it's good, it makes you stronger. Another school, and one with whom you probably have completely mistaken associations, are the Epicureans. Now think about what that word conjures up in your head, an Epicurean, right? It later comes to be associated with luxury and gluttony. But in fact, the original Epicurus espoused exactly the opposite. And let me tell you how he sort of gets a bad rap. Epicurus had the audacity to suggest that everything we do in life should be directed toward maximizing our pleasures and minimizing our pain. And when you're thinking about what to do, you kind of make a cost-benefit analysis to maximize your utility. And if you want to think of him as the kind of micro-economist of the ancient world, that makes perfect sense to me. But it turns out that some things, although they are very, very pleasurable in the short term, they cause much greater pain in the long run. So, you know, drinking a lot can be a whole lot of fun for a while until you have to deal with a hangover and you damage your health. So what he suggested is that we cut back on our needs and therefore we won't be disappointed. So for example, if you get used to eating caviar, suddenly when you can't get your caviar, as inevitably happens, right, you'll be really sad and much sadder than if you hadn't bothered with it in the first place. So ironically, Epicurus espoused a doctrine of simplicity, but the idea was not, you know, to strengthen your body, but it was an attempt to maximize pleasure, just to rationally figure out, how am I going to get the most pleasure out of this life? Now, the cynics are another school. You've heard that word. To be cynical means you sort of don't believe anything when it's told to you. Their founder, Diogenes, was a very odd fish. He lived in a barrel, apparently. He had nothing really interesting to say about food that's beneath him. But Diogenes is said to have done, let's say, embarrassing things in public as a way to just shock, you know, épaiser les bourgeois, just to shock the ordinary people. And apparently really not caring at all about what he ate, he just sort of stuffed a raw octopus down his throat and choked to death. And who knows if that's true, but it's at least the legend is so. There's the cynics, okay? So, but my larger point to be made here is that in Hellenistic civilization, there were many different ways to think about food, right? You could use food to show off your wealth. You could, you know, go on a diet and use it to maintain your health. You could use it to uphold your philosophical position, whatever, you know, sort of, you know, philosophies are not really just about ideas. They're about practice and ethics and ideas in action. And it was the, you know, Romans that adopted these many different ideas when they finally conquered Greece. So we'll see that these philosophical schools really do influence them. But before I get to Rome, two more civilizations that are more ancient demand our attention. The first of which became the eastern perimeter of Alexander's conquests. And of course, we're talking about the civilization of India. That's what we'll turn to next.